There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Unfiltered. I'm James O'Brien, shortly to be joined by the man who was Deputy Prime Minister and remains one of the most interesting politicians of our age. I speak, of course, of Nick Clegg. And I'm looking forward to this for two reasons. Number one, I've never got under his bonnet before, and I'm fascinated to know what we're going to find there. And number two, on a slightly self-referential level, this is the first sort of big, in terms of the length of it, interview that I've done with a politician, albeit that he's not in the House of Commons anymore, in quite a long time, pretty much since I stepped down from presenting Newsnight on the BBC so that I could carry on shooting my mouth off about Brexit and Donald Trump in my other work. So I'm keen to see whether I could remember how to do it. I have to confess, Nick Clegg, I missed your knighthood. It was only when I started swatting up prior.
No, don't worry. It's not the most important thing happened in the Christmas holidays.
Clearly, that's why, perhaps. It just sort of dropped off the radar. Has it changed your life, being ennobled in this fashion?
Of course not. It hasn't. It's a very nice thing to have. My mum likes it. It's nice to be recognised for stuff you do, but it's... the whole honour system is a bit
yes, of course.
Bit curious.
So. No, I just mentioned that because other people may not have realised your new status. I don't know where to start. Politically, it's tempting to start with what presumably feels like a lifetime ago when everyone agreed with Nick.
Oh, that's a long time ago.
Yes, but it is, in a way, when you found a gear that no previous Liberal Democrat leader had found for a couple of generations.
Looking back on it, oddly enough, I think it, the way I, perhaps with hindsight, view it, is that there was this very kind of sudden, frothy, slightly kind of swirly enthusiasm when, in fact, I was going, but I haven't said anything that I haven't said for years. So as a person, you're going, what's just happened?
Yes.
And then, of course, you realise that it's a bit like catching sort of being in this little sailboat and there's no wind. And then suddenly you get this gust of wind and you go, oh, gosh, where'd that come from? And I realised with hindsight that all I was tapping into is not anything to do with me or any innate sort of virtues on my part, was just this huge appetite for something different from what people had been, until then, of course, served up with. And in a sense, politics... one way to understand the kind of volatility of politics at the moment is that people are just casting around for one hero or one heroine before they quickly discard them and move on to the next. Just anybody who can satisfy that longing for something different from the status quo. And obviously I then, in a sense, in many respects, sort of became a part of the kind of furniture of the status quo. What else can one expect if you then go into government. But you just see a lot of that at the moment.
Yes.
You know, one moment it's Farage, then it's Corbyn, then it's this. It's just this
Trump.
This very restless and entirely understandable appetite.
Is it entirely understandable? Because the phrase we file it under on my radio show is, it doesn't have to be this way. And that's all that people need to hear, as you suggest, because they don't want detail.
In the case of the 2010 general election, I would simplify it even just down to one word.
Go on.
It sounds very trite, this, but I noticed when you did meetings and interviews and so on, if you just simply said, at that time, Brown and Cameron, they're the same old, same old. People want something different. It was just the word different.
Yes.
I hope that doesn't sound either oversimplifying things, but I do think we keep being taken, people keep being taken by surprise by how strong the appetite for something different is.
Yes.
And a good thing.
Where does it come from? Why is this appetite, in the course of your political career, gone from negligible to definitive?
A whole bunch of things. Clearly, stuff's been going on in the economy, which just quite, totally understandably.
Don't understand why they're standing still or moving backwards when they're playing by the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I can't test this.
Sure.
I strongly suspect I wouldn't have got that, that fleeting gust of wind in my sails in 2010. I don't actually think Corbyn would be held aloft by youngsters at Glastonbury now. I'd go even further. I don't think this country would have voted for Brexit or Trump would be president of the United States if 2008 had not happened.
Yes.
So a whole bunch of long-term reasons, the collapse of ideology, the end of the Cold War, technology, class, all that kind of stuff. But I think it is probably quite difficult to exaggerate the significance of 2008 for all the reasons which, a lot of people rehearsed, which is that, it was just such a sort of collapse in the basic transmission sort of mechanism of our modern capitalist system, and it left a lot of people hurting and still hurting now for the longest period of time in terms of the squeeze on people's take-home pay since records began, and those who were culpable, the politicians, the regulators, the bankers, people feel they got away scot-free. So I don't find that bit surprising. I of course would. It's quite a sort of liberal Lib Demy thing to say, perhaps, but I do think on top of that, we have a uniquely unresponsive political system, the risk of sort of immediately indulging in lots of sort of my old favourites and sort of electoral reform and House Lords, all that kind of stuff, which I won't, that's too boring. But I do think one of the things that people are missing is that in America you've got this populist eruption, Trump and so on. But actually, if in a really kind of sometimes ham-fisted, erratic way, actually the mechanism of holding people to account, checks and balances, scrutiny and so on, is kind of working in Washington, whether it's the Mueller investigation into the Russian stuff, whether it's congressional standoff with the White House. In many kind of European economies where constantly clever commentators would say, in Germany, Alternative for Deutschland's going to win. Podemos is going to win Spain. Geert Wilders is going to win the Netherlands. Le Pen's going to win in France. Actually, mainstream politics had more life in it still. We, oddly, I think, have a much more hollowed out political system. There are no checks and balances. None. There's this rampant, unaccountable power of these old men this clique of old men who run or edit, many of our newspapers.
Yes, that's gone nuclear
in the last three or four years. And it's nowhere else the case.
No.
It's nowhere else as extreme as this is now. So you've got no written constitution, you've got no checks and balances. We can have a sort of a referendum kind of like flippantly one Thursday afternoon because someone feels like it.
Yes.
No requirements on a particular majority. The House of Lords can't really challenge because they're not elected. You've got all the parties being financed in the same old way. And you've got all these kind of totally unrepresentative characters with a lot of money and a lot of prejudices as well, warping the debate. So I do think we're quite... There's all the economic stuff which people talk about, 2008, but there are also, in answer to your question, I think there's just this feeling which people can't quite pin down.
Yes.
But they're right to feel it, which is like... This just isn't working.
It's neoliberalism you're describing, isn't it?
Is it?
Sort of.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think
Corbyn supports.
I don't think having unduly or excessively powerful newspaper proprietors and editors is neoliberal. I don't think having an elected House of Lords is neoliberal.
I was thinking more of the idea of
people. Oh, the economics.
Yeah, the economics side. Not getting a return on their effort in the way that they would have done in previous generations, which is very, very frustrating. And of course, you haven't mentioned the refugee crisis. So if you've got the global financial crisis and the refugee crisis, that's like crossing the streams in Ghostbusters, isn't it? And that explains both sides of the Atlantic.
It is completely. And I often remark on this, but I actually think, looking back on it, it is extraordinary that 48% of people voted to remain.
I couldn't agree more.
That 16.1 million people, after 4 decades of anti-European propaganda, every night on your telly screen, pictures of these poor, poor people fleeing from Syria, and you're then told by Farage and Johnson and Gove, that's all the fault of the EU.
Yeah.
And we've been told for the last 10 years that with the Greek crisis and everything, their economy over on the other side of the channel is a basket case compared to ours. I think it's absolutely extraordinary that many people voted to actually stick with what we had.
2020 is an amazing thing, isn't it? But I agree with you. It is, especially if you read Tim Shipman's book, All Out War.
I haven't read it, but...
Oh, you must. I mean, it really is. It's superb. And you end it wondering how they got one vote.
Yes.
Apart from you.
Being nailed on.
Nobody else. I wasn't even. I didn't have strong views on it until it actually happened.
Very strong views before.
Well, clearly you did, because you were a European politician before anybody in this country really knew that we had European
Well, in one sense, of course, I literally was, because I was an MEP.
That's what
for
I mean.
5 years.
Yes. Oh, right, yeah. That was the very beginning of your career. People may not realise this.
Yeah, so, I was a Euro MP.
Checking the dates, you were barely out of short trousers when you arrived in the European Parliament.
Well, I'm 51 now, and I got elected in 99, so I was 32. Yeah. Is that really that?
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, it would have been fresh-faced on the domestic political scene.
Oh, yeah.
But you could go to Strasbourg and cut your teeth without coming to...
It's a much more
scrutiny.
Oh, it's a much more.
Why did you want to be an MEP?
I had been a. I had worked for a couple of years. More than that, 4 or 5 years for the European Commission.
Right.
And latterly, I'd worked for Leon Britton, who was the then Vice President of the European Commission, and he dealt with trade stuff. And I was not. I stress, I wasn't working for him as a sort of conservative sidekick. I was a technocrat. I was immersed in all these trade negotiations.
One of those experts.
Wash your mouth out. How dare you?
But where did you develop the enthusiasm? Because most people...
For what?
For the European political landscape. It was quite an odd thing for a 30-something Brit to have... fermented.
How do you think?
Leon Britton would be a better example. It's something you did after a Westminster career.
Well, firstly, we're all shaped by our own families and our own backgrounds and so on. And I have, I'm sort of condemned to be, in a sense, interested in Europe as a kind of wider place. My mum's Dutch, my dad's half Russian. My parents, both their families were very affected, as many families were, by the kind of wars and all the rest of it. And my mum spent her formative years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And my Russian grandmother, she settled in Putney, having sort of fled from Petersburg to Berlin and so I grew up, and we didn't sit around mournfully talking about this stuff.
It was
a very boisterous, cheerful family, but you do kind of just pick up imperceptibly as a kid that there's something quite unusual about having peace rather than war.
Yeah.
That Britain is particularly attractive because it's got this long, uninterrupted tradition of fair play and, parliamentary representative democracy and blah-de-blah. And so I kind of took all those kind of values it's just like a good thing for us to do stuff together rather than at each other's throats. I took that intuitively, I took it to heart, really. And then, remember, I don't even know how old are you?
46, five years younger than you.
I'm sure it'll apply to you. The most important moment for me growing up was the collapse of the Berlin Wall, undoubtedly. And it remains for my generation, I think, so I'm in my early 50s, the seminal moment, because I'd grown up as a kid. Actually, at times, I was personally quite anxious, as I think many people were, about the spectre of nuclear conflict. And I remember I had this eccentric history teacher who told us we were all going to be burnt to a crisp by Soviet nukes by Christmas. But there was this real sense in the kind of 70s and 80s, there's this real spectre hanging over us all. And suddenly all that went. And suddenly, Germans could talk to each other across... There had been a wall, and there was this amazing... So far from being a fuddy-duddy thing to kind of want to jump on board that European journey. It was actually a very, for me, one of great excitement and possibility. You know, you're allowing all these countries that have been under, you know, behind the Soviet curtain. Just mentioning the word Soviet curtain, I had this whole image in my head of this metal thing and you couldn't peer through it.
Course,
and suddenly it had been lifted. And so I actually, no, far from it, I was really kind of buoyed up by this idea of, oh, wow, we can kind of do things together in a place, a cluttered, you know, patchwork continent of ours, which before we couldn't. So I was always quite buoyed up by that.
And you describe it. I mean, two things occur to me. The first is it's a completely natural position that you've just described, but also that it's quite a rare one. That was really what I was alluding to. The
is
notion,
it? Yeah.
Well, that level of enthusiasm, it possibly explains some of what we were saying about the miracle of the Remain campaign getting any votes, because the idea of it being something to celebrate rather than tolerate, which was probably the closest you could come to typifying the Remain position, is I did an A level in politics in 1990, and I've never come across that sort of enthusiasm before.
The only thing I would say is, in as much as clearly, and boy, have I found this out, both to my benefit and often to my cost. I mean, the heart is a much more powerful organ than the brain when it comes to voting and politics and stuff. we are intensely emotional beings, however much we might pretend otherwise. And I do think the emotional attachment to the European thing, it just clearly has shallower roots in our country. For you know, we weren't on the losing side of the war. You know, if I look at my mum's Dutch, so particularly for her generation, she's in her 80s now, but for her and for anyone in those founding member states, Benelux, Germany,
this was the future.
But this was peace. Yes. It was above all, it was peace.
After centuries.
After these, this blood-drenched century, I mean, twice in a few decades, millions and millions of people being slaughtered. I mean, I think it's amazing how quickly we've forgotten what that does to the collective psyche of a place. My wife is Spanish. You speak to Spaniards, Portuguese, the Greeks in particular. For them, it was like, oh, wow, we're now at the top table of democracies, having shared fascism.
Yeah, fascist dictatorship.
So there was an emotional... Yes. If you're from Central Eastern Europe, it was kind of freedom after Soviet communism. These were all really powerfully positive emotions, coming to your point.
Yes.
Here...
Nothing.
It was never positively... It was never emotionally kind of believed and entrenched in people's hearts. I mean, I obviously was too young. I was, whatever, seven or eight, when the first referendum happened in the mid-70s. But if you read accounts of it, it was all about, you know, would New Zealand butter be a few pence more expensive? And we did it again in 2016. Yeah. We again talked about this big, I think, quite big ideological, historical issue, as if all you need to do is take a pocket calculator out in your local supermarket and work out what the cost and benefit of it is. So in a strange kind of way, you're right. We've never as a community, I think, had that same visceral emotional attachment related to our own identity as other countries do.
It's easy to see why when you put it like that. It's going to be the Joni Mitchell lyric, isn't it? Is it? You don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Yeah.
That might be the...
That's for sure.
But we shall see. We'll get on to that. When did you first frame an ambition to become a politician then?
I didn't have a sort of hallelujah moment. I was always interested in politics. In fact, we just touched on it for some of the reasons. The European thing, as we just talked about, was always kind of there. But I mean, I remember going once to a student debate. I was an undergraduate at Cambridge University. And so this was in the mid-80s. It was the height of the Thatcher Revolution. And it was just like, oh, it was awful. I'll never forget it. It was all these red-faced boys and girls in pearls and dinner jackets and screaming all these raging certainties at each other. And I was like any other student. I had many more questions than I did about answers. And I just completely fled. So I was not remotely interested in party politics. To be fair to him, I mean, I'm not sure if he'll welcome this. I think he will. But Paddy Ashton had a big impact on me. I remember he took this stand on something which now seems remarkably obscure and remote about whether folk from Hong Kong should have rights to British passports.
Yeah, after the accession.
And it was a very unpopular thing to say, you know, as we're quitting Hong Kong. He was sort of saying, well, of course, we have a moral duty to... As he, by the way, is still saying we have a moral duty to Afghan interpreters, for instance. And it just, I remember, it, for some reason, it caught my attention. I thought, all right, no one else is saying that. And, oh, he's sort of standing out from the crowd. So I remember that. Leon Britton, a Tory, I'll never forget. I used to constantly speak out of turn because I was supposed to sort of give him basically sort of civil service advice. And this was at the time when he and other people were being absolutely savaged by the right-wing press. I mean, very strong echoes to today for being pro-European Tories.
This would be the up yours, Delors sort of
all
era.
And there were in some papers... I remember this distinctly. There was stuff verging on, I thought, the anti-Semitic in the way he was portrayed. And I constantly would comment on it. I said, oh, this is ridiculous, that's ridiculous. I remember him once turning to me quite actually impatiently and said, look, instead of constantly going on about what you think is wrong with British policy, why don't you just get your hands dirty and go into it yourself. And I remember I was uncharacteristically stumped for words because I just had never occurred to me that that species of people, politicians, there's no doubt how people look at me now, that I had anything to do with them. I just thought that was a different planet.
Yes.
And so it was the first time someone said, well, you know, why don't you just get off your arse and do it? And from that, you know, that sort of sowed the seed in many ways. And then I remember sometime later telling him that I wanted to try to stand for the Lib Dems somewhere. I remember him saying, a bit sort of dismissively, sort of, oh, the Lib Dems, you can't, that's like standing for an NGO. And I sort of said, very defensive, no, it's not. They're saying good things, as indeed I think they were and are. But so that's the slightly haphazard journey. It's not, I can't pretend I had a...
Well, it's healthier, isn't it, than having formed a desire at... Well, how old was William Hague at the Conservative
Party? Yeah, whatever. No, I didn't. I remember you said earlier, maybe I started relatively early, but in my early 30s in election.
But as a natural progression rather than a career goal, rather than a box-ticking exercise.
Certainly looking back, it slightly sort of crept up on me. Yeah. It was not some preordained plan, and it certainly wasn't some Damascene conversion. And as I say, I do remember very distinctly, and it's quite important because I just hope anyone listening to this who might, you know, a youngster who's thinking, should I go into politics? Funny enough, the most difficult thing of all is to believe you can do it. Just to believe that, you know, you're as entitled as anybody else. And by the way, if that was a barrier for me, having gone to a public school, Oxbridge and West, you know, the kind of leap into this weird hammer beam sort of Harry Potter world of Westminster must seem even more kind of
alien.
Alien to others. So I do think that's quite important that you know, it's not
the notion of
world.
Accessibility. Jess Phillips said something interesting recently. I think it was Jess Phillips about the thickness of skin that's now required.
Yeah.
Because this worries me a lot.
Yeah.
The passage you've just described sounds almost idyllic in that you can be inspired by established politicians. You can even have enjoy the patronage of them if, as you suggest.
Yes, I was lucky enough. Yeah.
You were, but you didn't feel that simply putting your hand up politically was painting an enormous target.
No,
it has got.
I mean, I don't know how you measure it, and I'm not probably the best person to ask for an objective assessment. But you know, because I'm no doubt people would say I brought it on them myself in many respects. But you know, I experienced just this constant day in. I mean, for half a decade, just being torn limb from limb from right and left. And it
an odd position to be in, because from one or the other
commonplace. Yes, well, I'd rather, I wished it had been either one or the other. It's when, you know, when you get Polly Toynbee and Paul Dacre, who both hate you with equal vehemence, you know you're in trouble, if from completely different ideological perspectives.
I've never thought of it.
And for all the reasons that we don't need to, you know, people are familiar with the social media, the polarisation of politics, but something has gone a bit, it's just become so intemperate, so vituperative, so... I mean, people say stuff.
Yes.
And I always think psychologically it's like road rage. I mean, people say stuff, feel stuff, splutter stuff behind the wheel, and indeed, of course, behind a keyboard, that you would never, ever say to another human being. I remember, and boy, have I received my fair share of kind of, you know, bile from. But I remember, and I don't want to, I'm sure he didn't, maybe didn't know what he was saying. I'm sure he's a perfectly nice bloke, I didn't know him. But I remember there was a Labour MP when I was in coalition, and obviously the whole Labour narrative was all, you know, how dare you Judas Iscariot, you've sold out, but all that kind of. And I remember him, this was Barry Gardiner, and he was like red, and he almost spat out across the Commons. I remember saying, you are a Quisling. And I thought, does he know what that means? Mm. That is a Nazi collaborator.
Yes, yes.
And I thought, maybe he doesn't know what it means. But it has got to the point where people... Here's the thing. I don't think people feel they need to worry anymore about the words they use. You know, it's become... it's a funny environment because on one hand, people are becoming more sensitive about words to do with race, gender, disability.
This is the dichotomy of our times, isn't it?
So in a sense, we become semantically more sensitive and some would argue almost neurotic.
Yes.
And on the other hand, we'll say stuff about fellow human beings.
Yes.
And of course, what happens in politics, and this I think you just have to accept, and this was always the case. I think it would be false to... You do, the moment you put yourself, for public... And I accept, by the way, I strongly believe you should just accept this as comes par for the course. You're very quickly turned into something else. I mean, you are very quickly turned into a caricature of yourself. And I remember... And that's, I think that you just have to expect that because, of course, in politics, people deal in caricatures. And I remember when I was being, in a sense, caricatured by the left as a sort of, unprincipled weakling who'd sold out his progressive principles to just, to get a sort of whiff of power. And then the right sort of saying, this perfidious, ghastly Lib Dem, got no right to sort of have his foot in the door in power. And you see these the same adjectives being ascribed to you. And you get this almost cardboard cutout.
Yes.
Character. In the beginning, you're still thinking, surely no one's going to believe that. And then you realise that that's, to all intents and purposes, what you are to people. I think that's just the nature of the business, I think, because you just have to... But the way it's done, it has become...
It's hard to see a way back as well.
And funny enough, if I have any, I have many, many regrets. If there's one regret I have, I'm not sure if it would have done me much good, but I wish I had answered fire with fire more.
Yes,
I wish I had. Because if you're in government in particular, you're trying to focus on the day job. You can't spend all your life answering to Owen Jones on the left or Paul Dacre on the right. You can't.
No.
It's just a waste of time. And also, you're advised by all
to keep your head down.
Yeah, but you're advised by folk quite understandably who's their job, who sort of say, look, don't answer back because they can.
Yes.
They can slap your ugly mug on the front page of their newspaper and shove it through millions of people's, letterboxes tomorrow.
And
you just can't.
It'll stick.
And it'll go. Yeah, I must say, with hindsight, I wish I'd. I would advise anyone who ends up in a sort of position analogous to mine, where you really are getting at the neck. If you think you've got a really good, if you think it's really just going beyond the pale, don't stoically hold back, because actually, all that happens is that. Is that their bile goes unanswered, and
Corbyn looks like he might break that model, for all his
until
flaws.
He gets into government.
Sure, and then he
until
might
he gets
too.
Into government. I mean, I'm
still
afraid.
An if, isn't it? Not an until.
I think it's an if. Yeah, well, I think it's a big if. I'm not a sophologist,
sure.
And I should stress that pretty well every political prediction I made for the last 10 years proved to be wrong. So this one, no doubt, will be wrong as well. But having said all of that, those caveats notwithstanding, I think if the Labour Party is basically still at level pegging with this truly the most incompetent, hopeless government in modern era... if the British public still tell pollsters they think Theresa May is a more preferable Prime Minister than Jeremy Corbyn, you really have to ask yourself, where are the votes going to come from to effortlessly waft Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell in number 10? That's my hunch, but I personally can't see where they get extra votes from what they got
No,
last.
It's a bit chicken and egg, though, isn't it? Because the media climate you describe is never going to allow any... movement for the Corbyn McDonald model, rightly or wrongly, they're going to be typified times 10, what you described, when they're caricatured and when they're turned into hooks upon which to hang preconceptions and prejudices.
Yeah.
It's going to be like nothing we've ever seen before.
But they've got their troops, that's the thing.
Yes.
That's where
the Trump parallel works, isn't it? Because.
Yeah, so I had no troops, and that was, again, probably I just had no
foot
troops
soldiers.
At all. I had no if you don't have anybody on your side who's prepared to kind of spill some ink on a newspaper to defend you, no one is prepared to tell your side of the story, don't be surprised after half a decade that people believe the stuff, because that's the bit I wish if I were to do it again, which I won't, I'd think
sure?
longer and hard.
Very young.
You can't reheat old coffee. I don't think. But anyway, you can, of course, technically. But you know what I mean.
it's just what you're drinking.
So in a sense, what you've got at the moment with the polarisation of politics is, yes, of course, the right, you know, the Express, the Mail and all the rest of it will caricature Corbyn in whatever way they seek to. But he does at least have, you know, he's got his momentum troops, he's got a very strong social media stuff.
Yes.
In a sense, one of the things that I stumbled into, as much as by accident as by design, was into an absolute maelstrom of criticism. With no means, really,
you're just hiding for nothing. Did it hit you hard and quickly, or was it a dawning realisation?
Yeah, it was pretty quick.
I thought it would be.
But listen, I can't stress enough.
You want to be liked, don't you? You're not one of these. You do a bit. It's clear, even in this context, you're not one of those politicians. You're not like Anne Widdecombe.
No,
somebody who almost relishes alienating.
I don't think I am by nature. I don't think my mates would call me someone who's sort of naturally belligerent.
Precisely.
And I'm gregarious and so on. Yes. I don't think I've got a sort of, I think I've certainly been long, I'm long in the tooth enough now not to, no, I don't sort of hanker for.
I don't mean that you're needy. I just mean that it must have.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't go out of my way to, So, but here's a very good thing. It was a legitimate and remains a legitimate source of controversy about whether the savings in public spending that my government, that the coalition government started introducing from autumn of 2010 onwards, you know, was it a necessary step? Did it go over the top? Or was it some ideological assault on all the vulnerable, you know, the vulnerable and the poor and so on? And that is a totally legitimate kind of, you know, totally legitimate debate. I, of course, have my views, you know, as it happened. Anyway, never mind. But I did find quite quickly after we started unveiling these very big agonising decisions about public spending that I'd lost the ability to kind of tell the side of the story of that I thought was worth telling. And that was a mistake.
Lost it? How? Because
I just didn't have the either the wherewithal or the means to provide a story of what we were doing, which wasn't which, by the way, this again...
You mean a distinctly liberal Democrat?
Yeah, because quite understandably, the main messenger is Prime Minister and Chancellor in that case.
Yes.
So it became incredibly easy to just sort of impose a caricature.
Yes.
But hey.
So you became the patsy then, in a way.
On the narrative side of the story, it became... I think now the facts, in a sense, speak louder now with hindsight than they did at the time. I mean, as it happens...
Yeah, but they don't flatter you, do they? Because it would appear that the Conservative Party now has abandoned the argument that that austerity was a necessity. Because they haven't fixed as much stuff as they said they were going to. They haven't introduced as many improvements as they said they were going to. And now, without the Liberal Democrats in the passenger seat, they're pursuing policies that, they're not austerity anymore. And yet the project that austerity was supposed to address remains.
Well, herein lies a lot of different threads which can all get very mangled.
Of course.
Here's a fact.
Yeah.
So let's just start with the fact. The reduction in the deficit during the 5 years of the coalition was less than planned by Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling. Not only planned, they legislated for it. They legislated to slash the deficit in half in 4 years. We did it over a longer period of time, not least, by the way, because of decisions I took to stop Osborne and the Treasury going further.
Mm.
So the caricature of this red in tooth and claw austerity was always wrong.
Well, it's partly about where the savings were going to come
that,
from.
That is a totally legitimate issue. That is a totally legitimate issue. And now, again, the facts kind of show that we try to do it as progressively as possible. In other words, you know, the top 1% were paying much more tax under us than they ever did under Labour. The top 20% paid more than the remaining 80% combined. In fact, income inequality was less at the end of the coalition than it was at the end of Labour, not least because of these big tax changes we drove through in terms of raising the point at which you start paying income tax. So I believe...
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Leave? Not that all the... I think some of the welfare changes were ones that, you know, I would never do on my own. But again, you know, if you look what's happened since then, the Institute for Fiscal Studies and other people say, it's them saying it, not me, that the things that are really regressive on welfare are these, is this huge chunk of £12 billion of welfare cuts, which are being introduced now to working age welfare, which we blocked at the time. Anyway, look, I won't get into all this a lot, Nick Clegg.
You sort of go down quite substantive routes and then almost pull yourself back for fear of being boring or
because for fear of losing people. Because these are sort of illustrative
this
points.
This is the wonky stuff. This is back to your first days in Strasbourg.
It's evidence of a much simpler assertion.
Okay.
We're going down various tributaries now.
Yes.
Which is where I'm trying to illustrate with hindsight that once you lose a story.
Yes.
Once you lose an explanation of what came before, what you're doing, and what future you're trying to go for. Once you lose that story, you'll lose people. You'll lose support.
Yeah. Okay.
And when you lose the capacity to tell that story, I pulled back from all the facts and statistics, is because they are just there to illustrate that I felt that it was a legitimate story, which could have been well told. Since it wasn't told at all, it was no wonder, in a sense, that the story that was told instead was one which I don't think kind of did justice to what was going on.
There's that anecdote about William Hague. I don't know where it had its source or how true it is, that he went home after the coalition agreement had been put together and told his wife that he thought they might just have finished off the Liberal Democrats.
Yes, I read that, yeah.
Does that chime with your memories of
Oh, certainly not at the time. I mean, look, there's a real issue, which is that I don't think anybody, I mean, Joschka Fischer did it for a brief time in Germany as a junior coalition partner in the government then, and Jim Wallis, actually, in the first coalition government in Scotland with Donald Dewar.
Yes.
They kind of survived. Other than that, you will not find a single example anywhere, of a junior coalition partner who doesn't get completely mashed up. And it's just...
But you knew this when you signed up for it.
Well, perhaps I didn't know it quite with the force that I... And then you don't listen, it was a gamble. It was a massive gamble.
What were your choices in 2010? Well, I mean, genuinely...
So the choice was either no government at all
or
a government with the Tories.
You'd never have thrown your lot in with the Labour.
Would there still
have been a parliamentary majority?
No.
Oh, wouldn't there? My mistake.
No, we were 11 seats short.
So it would have been another election.
There would have been turmoil, blah, blah, blah. So it was a much more... I mean, no, it's funny you should say that. So I was doing an event at the university here in London the other day, and a young, angry sort of lefty sort of said to me, oh, you know, all this ghastly stuff that's now happened. It wouldn't have happened if you'd chosen to go into coalition with Gordon Brown. I said, look, I didn't sit around plucking petals from a daisy saying, is it Gordon, is it Dave? There was no arithmetical majority which could sustain a Liberal Democrat Labour. As I kept telling Gordon Brown, he kept coming out with all these arcane
ways. That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
My mistake comes from the fact that Gordon Brown thought it was plausible.
You should get him onto your podcast. He's got the whole story in his head that somehow he was cheated out of. He lost the pleading election.
Yes,
that wasn't my doing.
There's no dressing that up, is there?
And there's certainly no dressing up the maths. I'm afraid. It's an irrefutable fact that there was not a Lib Dem Labour majority.
So
it was about, do you go into government at all or not? And I mean, lots of things. I think the thing that probably people have now forgotten is how sort of economically and socially fragile the country felt in the spring of 2010. And I think it's difficult for folk who don't remember that to kind of really... kind of immerse yourself in an atmosphere of a real sense of it. We're teetering on the edge of a cliff, and you know, I remember the election was on the Thursday, and Alistair Darling rushed off on the Sunday to an emergency European Economic Finance Ministers meeting, and there were demonstrations and riots on the streets of Athens, and cars burning, you know, on pictures on our television screen, and we had the most oversized banking system as a sort of relative to the size of our economy, pretty well anywhere in the developed world. We had the biggest peacetime deficit ever. There was real fear. You know, I had people like Mervyn King and others ringing me saying, please form a government, otherwise the bond markets are going to massacre us. So I think I can't prove this to you, but I suspect of the many ingredients that led to the formation of the coalition, the sense that we just couldn't afford several more months of faffing around politically was very, very strong indeed.
Had you contemplated the word coalition before that result came in? It didn't.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
you,
no.
You had thought.
Oh yeah, yeah. No,
because you do the maths and you think. Well,
oh
this
yeah, yeah.
Could
no, no. I'd always expected that if the Lib Dems at that time were going to have a crack at government, it was probably going to be the election after 2010.
Right.
Because I couldn't have predicted this kind of you know, whatever, we got 24% of the vote. You know, got more people voting for us in 2010 than at any time since the party was formed. And of course, I couldn't have predicted that. But it wasn't rocket science.
No, of course.
Everyone knew that it could happen. So I'd asked a bunch of people, Danny Alexander, David Laws, Andrew Stunnell, Chris Hune, to kind of, for months beforehand, to kind of
without knowing which one it would be with.
Literally, to kind of map out what you know, what
modelling, as it were, or economic impact.
War gaming,
impact analysis.
That sounds all much more military and organised than it was.
But
just
it
the
happened.
Lib Dems, after all.
But it happened, and it meant you had a degree of readiness that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, two things. The party's performance nationally, despite the Brexit policy, and you losing your seat in Sheffield. That is the turnaround, isn't it, for both the party's fortunes and your personal political fortunes?
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, I'm rather sort of sanguine about. I mean, you lose your seat. I mean, you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Yes.
I kind of like. I've never.
And I think
we
forget on Civvy Street how many elections you lot fight, and everyone in a seat like Sheffield Hallam is safe-ish in some context, but it's not one of those ones where they weigh the vote. There's no real constituency where you weigh the Lib Dem vote.
There's no such thing as a Lib Dem safe seat.
Exactly. So that
contributes to your
sanguine.
And also, don't go into politics if you think you're going to sort of. I mean, you know, obviously, it's easier for Labour and. If a Labour and Conservative careerist, if they can find the right seat, they basically know they've got a sort of job for life. You can stick a blue rosette on a, you know, on a pig in large parts of the country, or indeed on a red rosette, and they'll be returned. It's just not the case in the kind of party that I chose. So I oddly enough, I don't want to sound blasé about it, but you know, the cookie crumbles in the way that it does. And ironically enough, because in as much as anyone cared to comment about the election last year, the kind of immediate ready explanation was, that's the students, you know, taking out their revenge. But actually, what happened was something quite different. Was the Labour vote went up a bit, not much. Lib Dem vote went down a bit, not much. It was the Conservative vote doubled in Sheffield Hallam.
And
this was lots of people. And they told me on the doorstep.
Yeah.
I remember distinctly having a conversation with a very nice lady in a very neat, just outside a very neat bungalow, a perfectly manicured lawn. It's in a very nice part of southwest Sheffield. I remember the moment thinking, oh, God, that's not great. And she's cheerfully greeted me. Hello, Nick, how are you? Thank you for everything you're doing. I remember saying, to resurface our roads and pavements here, it's marvellous, dear. But I'm not going to vote for you this time.
Oh.
I said, oh, Mrs. Miggins, whatever. And they were, oh, right, well, why? Well, I think you're just, and I remember her saying, you're just being beastly to Theresa about Brexit.
Gosh.
Beastly to Theresa, I remember saying. I said, well, yeah, but please, don't, you know, there won't be a next time if you vote. And then she said, oh, come on, dear, of course you'll still win. And I remember thinking...
This was the human Brexit, is all these votes that were cast to make a point expecting it to be the result.
Most closely fought seats in this country are often decided by people who have a natural affiliation to one party saying, I'll go for the devil I
just
know, or
now.
The one I least dislike,
yes.
You know, what they call tactical voting in the jargon. And someone like me had clearly sustained a majority over several elections, in part by persuading Conservative voters that I was a preferable MP, though not ideal from their point of view, than the Labour alternative. And I think because I've, in a sense, have been doing it for 12 years, they probably thought, oh, well, you know, carry on anyway. And then I obviously pissed them off about the sort of my stance on Brexit. So I kind of thought, well, there's not much I can do about that. So...
Fair enough.
There you go.
But what about the party? Do you understand why the party's performing so badly?
I do a bit, actually.
So I forgot that you were the filling in a Vince Cable sandwich, effectively. Tim Farron being the sort of gherkin. But he was the acting leader before you took over. And,
yes.
And he's the leader again now. And the party is... You can say it's in the doldrums, can't one?
Well, the party seems to be stuck on... I mean, look, first, I think, much though I'm very passionate about this Brexit issue, I think it's important not to confuse one's own passions with that of most normal human beings. There are a chunk of people who care passionately about in favour of Brexit, a chunk of people who care about it passionately against, the other way. The vast majority of the most important people of all, the kind of swing voters, just, I mean,
A bit ambivalent.
I've certainly met a lot of people who just say, well, I'm a bit irritated being asked about it in the first place.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them are developing reservations about it and doubts about it and qualms about it, but it's not top of their list of concerns.
What did you think immediately you heard that your former colleague, David Cameron, was calling this? I mean, I know it was in the manifesto, but you could have kicked it down the road.
There was a bit of history about that because, of course, he kept going on about it when we were in coalition together, and even fleetingly at one point sort of tried to interest me in, you know, could we do this together, you know, as a coalition government, to which I said, it's not my job to sort of sort out your internal party problems.
Great job.
And then he gave this speech. You know, do you remember this? It was ridiculous. Week after week, there was endless drum roll in the press. Is he going to give a speech? Is he not going to give a speech? Went on. Eventually gave this speech, made this commitment to a referendum if he was returned as a sort of Conservative-only prime minister. And I remember thinking at the time, I said, well, he's locked himself in now. There's no way out of that. And funny enough, whilst, of course, it became increasingly implausible as the election wore on, there was quite an expectation at the beginning of this is now going back to 2015 general election, that there might be another repeat of the coalition. In other words, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives might have to...
And the Independent came out for that, didn't they? One of the newspapers.
And I remember on the eve of the election having a pizza at David Laws's house with David and Danny Alexander. David, Danny and I were very close. We've worked together. We've been through a lot in the sort of trenches in Whitehall together. And I remember Danny and David sort of speculating about, you know, if we returned X number of MPs, which, of course, in the event we didn't, and the Conservatives were to rely on our support, what would we kind of, you know, could we, I remember talk over the pizza and beer, you know, could the Liberal Democrats demand control of the Treasury and the Chancellorship if they were going to demand a referendum on our membership of the European Union? Mm. And I remember sort of listening to David and Danny and then saying to them, look, I can't do this. I mean, I just can't remote. You're going to have to find someone else. If you couldn't have led a party into coalition with a government giving a referendum. I remember very distinctly thinking and saying and feeling and saying to them, I said, look, I don't know how the cookie's going to crumble, but I personally just cannot do anything which would risk us, be a co-author of something which might lead us to leaving the European Union. Because I'd had such a, you know, I'd seen the absurd way the Conservative Party deals with Europe. I mean, this crazy kind of psychodrama constantly, this paranoia, this vitriol, this vituperation, this bonkers way that they portray Europeans as sort of ghastly, perfidious foreigners who are constantly trying to do us over. I mean, just the whole thing is just like a sort of subversion of allo allo, you know.
Yes.
I mean, unbelievable. And so I'd had no faith in how they'd handle it. And I remember just saying to Danny and David, look, I just... You know, this may not arise, and indeed it didn't. But I couldn't do it. I think Cameron. So when he then won, he had no alternative.
Of course. Do you think he felt hidebound by it a bit, or?
I think he had decided. I've heard some people say, oh, you know, he had calculated they might have to do a deal with you and you'd stop him doing it.
Right.
I don't actually funnily believe that. It's all very ridiculous. By the way, cock up almost always is more true than conspiracy. I think in his case, he gave that commitment to the Bloomberg thing, knowing that he'd have to do it if he wanted to basically carry on being leader of the Conservative Party. I think it was as sort of visceral as that.
Fair enough. It's a gun to his head, effectively. Ambition as well.
I'll tell you one thing which did slightly... I mean, all these things are connected. I do think that, again, with the benefit of hindsight, I think the surprise result, if that's the way to put it, of the Scottish referendum, and then, of course, the surprise outcome of the 2015 general election, did kind of go to the head of the Tory High Command. I think they kind of thought that they were political geniuses and that they kind of understood politics better than anybody else. And, you know, in as much as hubris is an ancient, you know, vice, we all suffer from it from time to time. I think the Tory High Command did. I think the Scottish referendum, the surprise win in 2015, led them to think that it was going to be more of a breeze, the referendum, than it. And of course, these people had never dealt with. I mean, I said this to them jokingly to Osborne and Cameron. They never dealt with, these sort of unhinged, snarling characters like Paul Dacre on the other side of the fence. They never had to do battle with these people. No. They never had to do battle with the kind of right-wing press in full cry. So for them, it was just like, whoa.
Well, even more so, they'd had the wind of the world, right-wing press in their sails.
Yes, of course.
To have it blowing a gale force.
They always had the attack dogs ready to be let off the leash at any point.
Just prior to Ed Miliband's dead father being a traitor to the name. I mean, there really is. That's an early indication of where we were going, isn't it, actually, when the fear of Ed Miliband getting into that.
Yeah, and then I mean, then if you speak, if you must, if you can bear it to some of these folk, the Leveson thing sort of dripped sort of poison into the relationship between politics and the media. Yeah. I think they completely lost the plot about what Leveson was about. It wasn't some draconian plan. I mean, for heaven's sake, every single industry in this country
has some form of
recourse and redress if things go wrong, but for some reason they think that's an infringement on their primitive liberties.
Do you think fondly of David Cameron now?
As a person? No, as a person, we always got on well.
Seemed to get on particularly well in the early days, but that had the sort of.
I think it was a little overdone. I mean, because there was this sort of sun dappled press conference.
Yeah, it was sun dappled.
Yeah, I know, but what I mean is the optics were great. And of course, it was. We were both very relieved. It's a knackering thing, by the way, general elections.
Yes.
And then we had on top of that, when your whole body is aching just to go to sleep, we then had 4 or 5 days of. No sleep and these endless coalition negotiations. So there was a great sense of relief. And then it was like this new thing. Oh, wow, right. Mm. So it's not two, it's not one person that had this government, it's two. And then the weather was nice and everyone was very cheerful. And there was a bit of, I think people slightly over-interpreted that. It was and remained a pretty hard-headed transaction, as it should do. We were not there to sort of be mates.
No.
Like most people, he had his bad sides, good sides, but he was easy to work with.
Who wasn't in that cabinet?
Quite a lot of them.
I'm sure, but...
Well, I mean, our dear current Prime Minister was... I mean, it was just... agonising to try and get decisions out of her and her team.
But she was strong and stable.
I mean, I'm so amused by these macho folk like Nick Timothy. I barely knew what he looked like during government, who's now sort of strutting around thinking he's never, as far as I can make out, won or fought an election in his life. So terribly macho. But, her team were just notorious in Whitehall for just being congenitally incapable of making decisions. And I remember I used to... And by the way, she was perfectly punctilious and polite and all the rest of it, not a bad or rude person, but just this curious either lack of confidence or lack of willingness to take decisions. And I just do think this...
Well, that leads us neatly to
it's coming
today,
back to haunt us
now.
It? Yeah, it's amazing.
So you could have been the early... I mean, what did you think when you saw Paul Dacre's front page of Theresa May mocked up like a cross between Britannia and Margaret Thatcher with a strong and stable... I mean, you must have been sitting there... Yeah. Either you've missed something huge over the course of the 5 years of coalition government, or the country is now about to hop out of the frying pan into the fire.
It was very obvious that, and of course it's interesting, because given how sort of dismissive they are of their own opponents. I mean, it's important to remember that Paul Dacre... basically hand-appointed.
Yes,
so hand-selected Theresa May.
He ran the rule over Andrea Leadsom,
and then,
didn't he?
Exactly. And basically when he said it's Theresa, whatever, that was done and dusted. Then sought to confer upon her sort of Joan of Arc, Boudicca type qualities, which I instantly knew were just laughable, and anybody who knew anything.
Do you think he knows that?
The thing is, what's interesting is that, he lost the election as well.
Yes.
I mean, that's the key thing to remember. These people are losers.
Yes.
I hate to have to admit that, but they're losers. They're not good at what they're doing.
Mm.
They're losing readers and they lost the election. So they don't have...
Losing power.
Yeah. And of course, that's what they don't like.
So they get angrier and
more
hateful.
It's like wild animals around a disappearing waterhole.
Yes.
The more the waterline recedes, the more vicious they get.
Yes.
And so it's going to get very, very vicious because it's that old order which is being threatened. And they'd used this perfectly decent, technocratically diligent, but relatively unimaginative politician in Theresa May to deliver a revolution.
An impossible revolution.
And she's a home counties Tory. Home counties Tories don't deliver Maoist revolutions, and that's why she's and So in a sense, I feel sorry for her because I think she's been sort of hoisted onto this sort of platform by the, you know, the Dakers, yes, and all these Brexit, the Brexit elite, you know, run our country. And they, of course, she can't sustain their hopes. The one bit where I'm more unforgiving of her is this, is that I do have this old-fashioned belief that if you aspire to lead a party or a country or a government, it is kind of your job to be able to be big enough to take kind of the long view, mm, and to see the wood from the trees and to kind of realise that you've got a kind of moral duty to the future, not just the present. For you. I mean, without getting mawkish,
well,
you know, your grandkids and the kids, yeah, not you. And I kind of think if you're a prime minister who's inherited this very, very finely divided referendum vote, just 650,000 votes in it, and crucially, if you as prime minister know that young voters overwhelmingly vote for something different, I kind of think at that point you've really got to just stop and think and say, right, how do I now move forward in a way which will stick and is sustainable and can bring people together. And if she'd said on that day when, you know, after David Cameron disappeared in a puff of smoke and she was standing on number 10, if she'd said, look, and I didn't believe in the Brexit, but it's happened and people have voted for it, if by a narrow margin, Brexit means Brexit, da da da. But if she'd gone on to say, but I'm really mindful of the fact that, you know, we're a divided country, yes, north, south, rich, poor, young and old, and I've got to act for the whole country, and that's why I'm going to do this now in a spirit of compromise. And I'm not going to throw the economic baby out with the bathwater. I'm not going to turn our backs on the great creation of my forebear, Margaret Thatcher, the single market.
Yes.
I'm going to disappoint tedious Ramoners like Nick Clegg, who thinks we shouldn't leave at all.
But I'm also going to let my own...
Do you know what? I don't know what you feel. I, of course, would think, oh, bugger, I wish we'd still stay in. But I like to think I'd be fair enough to say, do you know what? Fair dues. That is a statesperson-like response to this atom-splitting moment in our British, in our public life. The bit I find and still found then and still find unforgivable,
yes,
in a mature democracy is that you basically say, I don't give a damn what half the voting public think. And crucially, I don't really give a damn at all what the people who have to inherit this mess feel, the young. And that's the bit, and that's driven by these swivel-eyed, unrepresentative nutters like Dacre and others.
And their fear of them.
And I reckon if she'd reached out, in a sense, to that
the
middle
people,
ground,
as it were,
I reckon she would have quite quickly built up her own status and would have escaped this hapless position which she's in as a hostage to these wholly unrepresentative,
yes,
vested interests. Now, yes, they're powerful, they've got money and they've got newspapers, but they're unrepresentative. Because, you know, let me be clear, the British people left to their own device would never, ever vote for this hard right.
No, of course
vision
not.
Of the
no,
future.
This is
of course not.
People speak of coups. I mean,
yes, it is. Well, it is. It's an ideological coup. Of course, it is.
And she's
the puppet on the end of their strings. Yeah.
It leads us neatly to your slim volume, How to Stop Brexit.
Very readable.
It is very readable. Is it still very plausible?
I think so. Oh no! Let me be clear. It is of course more likely, you know, if you're a betting person,
yes,
some kind of, you know, rubbish fudge will be inveigled through the House of Commons towards the end of this year, and Brexit in some sort of hapless fashion will happen. But I think the chances of it not happening are actually a little bit higher than many people appreciate. So I think it's not the most likely outcome, but it is more possible than people think. For the reasons I don't think I need to rehearse to someone who's as articulate about this as you are. I mean, it's just the fundamental contradictions.
The brick wall that you keep coming up against surely has to break at some point.
You know, at some point,
yes,
you can't keep claiming you're going to have your cake and eat it when it is just not available. And by the way, just to bring us right bang up to date, I don't know when this is coming out, but the news today is full of this leak about the internal Whitehall analysis,
yes,
of the economic effects, which shows that under any scenario, Brexit leaves us worse off. Really interestingly, if you look at the fine print of the reporting, at least, according to this Whitehall analysis, so this is the government's own analysis, if you do trade deals with America, with China, with India, with Australia, with all these current countries, with the English-speaking world, it amounts to less, in terms of benefit to us, to less than 1% of GDP. This, you know, the fundamental... delusion, and it is a delusion, is that there is this big, wide, swashbuckling, buccaneering, free trade world out there, and we have been prevented from participating. Yes. It is nonsense.
Yes.
And it's, sometimes you kind of just have to believe that nonsense will be revealed for what it is.
Unless you have to do it to reveal it. That's the other possibility. Unless you actually have to get there before you realise that the cupboard is empty. You're not going to be able to persuade people that the cupboard is empty before they've gone over the line.
But I'll tell you one other thing, which I'm sure you've... The other thing which has happened in the wake of the referendum is that the fact of the referendum has lobotomised politics, because it's really interesting. I speak to lots of Conservative Labour MPs, and they talk about public opinion now as if it's the weather. They talk about public opinion might turn, and this might happen to public opinion. It's extraordinary. And you say to them, but... where is the belief in politics that you can try and persuade or cajole or lead public opinion? It's not something which you just sort of observe, and that's extraordinary. So there's been this catastrophic collapse in the
conviction.
Belief that there is such a thing as political leadership. Now, listen, people will no doubt say, "Oh, yeah, well, Clegg, you know, he led his troops." Well, maybe, but I still always try to lead. I always still try to say, "Look, let's try and go that way." Maybe it was the wrong way. Maybe didn't work. But this idea that you sit there and just wait.
Yes. Well, do you know what you told us that speaks to that most directly is that notion that if there had been some form of 2015 coalition, you would have fallen on your sword if the party wanted to do it. You would, in a way.
I mean, as it happens, I don't think my party would have wanted to do it.
Doesn't matter. The fact that you'd had that conversation with Danny Alexander and David Laws and others, that's what you're describing, is that sense of, well, there must come a point where clinging on.
Oh, God, yeah.
Isn't, whereas Theresa May has become the embodiment of clinging on. Yeah. What I'm interested in, we're going to run short of time.
Yeah.
Is her time now to be the recipient of the vituperation and the bile? Because it has to happen.
Yeah, revolutions eat themselves. Well, that's what's going to happen.
It's delusion management. Yeah. And you're left now really with Jacob Rees-Mogg somehow becoming the great king across the water, because he's the only one left that hasn't had his rhetoric redefined by reality.
Exactly. And so what you get, and which is in a sense why, in a sense, maybe people like me are very much of the past, is that, you know, what I mean by this is, let me be quite precise, it's not as self-serving as it sounds. You have a natural, I think, drift towards what I'd call cartoon politics.
Mm.
Because the zealots have to double up on their on their zeal, right? You have to find the next bunch of people who betrayed you.
Mm.
So, you know, I was the person who apparently betrayed the left, so they go nuts. Now the right feel they're betrayed by civil servants or by judges, or of course by foreigners.
Yes.
And so it goes on. So it's this insatiable need to displace any responsibility. So responsibility goes out of the window, right? And it really is this almost quasi-Maoist belief that if you just keep persisting with a long march, as long as you slay enough people who should take the blame on the way, then eventually utopia will beckon. And that's why, and who thrives in an environment? Well, of course, cartoon characters.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know Rees-Mogg. I'm probably sure he's a perfectly nice bloke, but he's a cartoon politician.
Of course.
And it's replete with this double-breasted pinstripe.
It's Boris Johnson squared, isn't it?
Yeah,
really,
and exactly. And Boris Johnson will soon appear like a character of great subtlety and integrity and honesty and consistency. I mean, so this is the problem, is that... And I do actually think, without ending on an unduly gloomy note, it is the biggest thing that worries me of all, which is that as we see this churning kind of rage, my question constantly is, where does the rage go next? You know, what happens in Rust Belt America when they discover that a Mexican wall does not suddenly restore all the jobs to the steel town? What happens in parts of the northeast, northwest, who quite rightly feel abandoned by the status quo when they discover that Brexit is not, you know, does not deliver is not a walk in the park? They're not all, I'm afraid, suddenly going to become reasonable on the one hand, on the other, Lib Dems or Democrats.
No.
So that's the worry. And so you have to kind of, and now look, that's why what's going on in France is so important, because there you're seeing an experiment, and at the moment it's nothing more than an experiment in Macron's hands of trying to kind of break the populist cycle abruptly and radically. And so a lot hinges on whether he succeeds, I think. Because if he doesn't, and actually that's just a sort of interlude before Le Pen does take up the reins. So there's a lot in the balance now, to put it mildly.
Which is a neat point to draw a line under this. Nick Clegg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's time now for the customary post-match analysis with Unfiltered's producer, Rich. I enjoyed that, but it was meaty, I think. Was it too meaty?
I don't think it was too meaty. I think, well, look, we had the former deputy prime minister.
That's what I kept reminding myself when I thought I wasn't getting enough.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to...
He was there, and he was in the passenger seat of the car. Well, he was on the deck of the ship.
Absolutely,
as it sailed
yeah.
for 5 years into the political climate that we're struggling with now.
Yeah, I don't want to say just, you know, wind him up and let him go, but,
no.
I mean, you did well sort of getting out of the way of just letting him...
Good.
You know, communicate his experiences about that time.
Yes.
And he's quite funny as well, actually.
He is quite funny, very human. I mean, I got completely back to, I think it was pretty much the first question we asked was a reminder of the I agree with Nick. You're quite a lot younger than me. So we're going back 8 years, and it was the you know, the Prime Minister's debates where Gordon Brown and David Cameron spent most of their time saying, I agree with Nick. And it was a lovely starting point. And then to end on a personal level, understanding why. You know, there is a real warmth to him, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. And for people my age, I was 20 when that election was on, so I was at university, and I was very much the kind of sort of demographic he was targeting. You know, he wanted to speak to people like me, and he did. You know, you mentioned the debates, like, I'm sure you remember, like, he was the first one that looked down the lens at the camera at the audience rather than just talking, you know, generally. Yeah, I thought he was fascinating.
Do you feel personally betrayed by him when the tuition fees thing kicked in?
I think there was a time where I probably would have felt betrayed like that, but I think that to some degree your hands are tied, really, aren't you? You know, you're the minority party in a coalition, and if they're not going to budge on it, there's not much you can do about it.
Give and take, you can walk away. But as you said, I thought that was really interesting. I don't know whether that was a slip of the tongue when he told us that Mervyn King, who was governor of the Bank of England at the time, was ringing him up, telling him to form a government, because the instability that would have ensued if he hadn't would have obviously been quite considerable.
Yeah, so, I mean, if that's why you get into government, stop things collapsing, even if that means you have to break your campaign promises.
Seems legit.
Seems difficult.
Legit, as your generation say, doesn't it?
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.